Welcome to the Children's Law Podcast, brought to you by True North Child Advocates, where we believe that advocacy is the answer. Hey everybody, this is Angela Orkin. All of us at True North Child Advocates hope you're having a great start to 2020. Today's episode is an interview with Judge Scott Bernstein that I was able to do at the Summit Georgia's Child Welfare Conference in the fall. I was very pleased to have the opportunity to sit down with Judge Bernstein. He spent about 22 years on the bench as a circuit court judge in Miami. He spent most of his time presiding over cases involving children, so his passion is working with children and their families. If you enjoy listening to the Children's Law Podcast, we would love it if you would take the time to pass it along to another lawyer or person in our community that might benefit from listening. Now, I hope you enjoy this interview with Judge Scott Bernstein. So today you're talking to a big crowd here in Georgia about implicit bias. And I'm just curious, what brought you to this particular focus?
Well, I think I need to step back and start from the beginning. So I'm very involved in judicial education. I believe strongly that judges need to train each other about how to do their jobs well. And when I first asked to start getting involved in judicial education, they assigned a topic to me to teach for the first time, and it was about the overrepresentation of racial minorities in juvenile delinquency cases. And I had a sense that I knew something about the subject, but like the good A-type personality I am, I went and started doing all kinds of research, and the situation was far worse than I expected it to be, and I became engrossed in the subject and saw all kinds of other inequities in our system, and that's what started me on the journey. In 1999, I think, or maybe 2000, certainly no later than that, and I've learned a lot about the science of implicit bias. I've studied a lot of the research that's been published. There's a lot more that is coming out every day. Technology has turned out to have been a good tool for measuring implicit bias and sometimes even for countering implicit bias.
Well, I have to ask you now that since you've been at this for approaching 20 years, are we doing better?
Yes, we are doing better. We still have an awful long way to go. And we're doing better in some areas and not so much better in others. I think that we're doing a little bit better in gender bias. We have a lot more road to travel on racial equity. And then there are a whole host of other issues that we still need a lot of work on as well.
Could you take a minute and explain to our audience why we all need to be thinking about this?
If anyone feels that he or she is not biased, then they're not self-aware at all. Everyone, and I mean everyone, holds some kind of bias. That doesn't necessarily have to be a bad thing. There's a lot of information that comes through our ears and in our eyes every day, and we have to be able to process it very quickly. And the way our brains process things is by categorizing bits of information. For example, if I told you that I was holding something in my hand, and it was round, and it was red, it was a piece of fruit, and it was delicious, your brain might categorize that quickly and say that's an
apple,
except it's a pomegranate. So your brain will make connections with things very quickly if you're familiar with them. And sometimes that really helps because you can't go through life analyzing every minute bit of information in front of you. You have to categorize things. But sometimes our categorizations are incorrect. And so that doesn't mean that we're all racists, but it does mean that we all make assumptions. And sometimes those assumptions are not true.
How do I catch myself in, you know, in my day-to-day practice as a lawyer representing kids?
So I think the first thing to do is to take an online test that's been done through Harvard called the Implicit Association Test. The website address is implicit.harvard.edu. And this is the gold standard test. It's something that has been validated thousands and thousands, probably hundreds of thousands of times, statistically by researchers over many, many years. Essentially, what they do at Harvard is they have you sit in front of your computer. You put your hands over the I key and the E key, and things pop up on the screen, and with your two fingers, you sort things. And they time you by the millisecond to determine how quickly you categorize things. And then they mix it up in a certain way. So, for example, and I'm going to be doing this later today with the folks here at the Georgia Child Welfare Summit, I'm going to flash up images on a screen, and I'm going to have them sort in the room. It's not quite the same as doing it online. Online is better, but in a big conference room with 600 people, this is the best you can do. I have people sort things between male and female, and I'll throw up words, for example, and I'll tell you anything having to do with a career, sort that in the male column. And anything having to do with family, sort that in the female column. And people will do the sorting. And then I'll say, now let's reverse it. And now if it's a word having to do with career, let's sort that in the female column. And if it's a word having to do with male, with a family, let's sort that in the male column. And invariably, it takes you a fraction of a second longer to put the word babies under the man's face and a fraction of a second longer to put the word corporation under the female face, even though the room is full of highly educated, very accomplished professional women. And that's because we're raised in a society with certain assumptions, and those assumptions aren't always accurate. And it lets you realize when you take this test, we all trip over this. Every one of us trips over this. And when you do it online, they actually tell you by the millisecond just how much of a bias you have. And the Harvard test has one on race, has one on weight, has one on sexual orientation, has one dealing with Native Americans. There are dozens of different tests that you can take, and I would urge everybody to go online and take a few. They're very enlightening, and the good part is that it's done in the privacy of your own home or office, but you may find things about yourself that you aren't really happy with. But it is also completely confidential. So you'll know what you need to work on, and that's the place to start.
So in addition to how you categorize, the time it takes you to do it factors then into, because you gave the example where you tell people where to categorize, but in the test itself, you just do it, you make the choice yourself, or right. Is it similar?
Online, you do the sorting yourself, and they test you very quickly by how long it takes you to do it. And the lesson, I think there are many lessons to learn from this, but the biggest lesson is that we can all get the right answer if we give ourselves enough time. And people always ask me, how do we combat implicit bias? And there are lots of strategies and a great deal of research that's being done about this. The first step you take in combating implicit bias is to slow down. When you are rushed for time, when you have a lot of pressure on the job, the phones are ringing, judges are waiting, you've got a hearing coming up, you've got, it seems like, 1,000 clients waiting to hear from you. Not that being pressured for time is something a lawyer ever has to deal with, right?
If only, right?
So when you're under stress, that's when you're most likely to rely on your implicit assumptions, which may have come from the time you were 3 or 4 years old, but they're not always accurate. So the best thing you can do, slow down. Take a deep breath, because I guarantee you that everyone who wants to do the right thing, if given enough time, will know how to do the right thing.
It's interesting that you pick time, because that's, you know, in all the talking to lawyers around the country that we do, that always seems to be, you know, one of the greatest struggles is how do you have enough time to meet your clients and meet the parents and the foster parents and everybody else. But it's an excellent point, and it makes perfect sense. I wanted to go back, though, to let's say I go on and I take it and I find, you know, some bias here, more bias there. Can I change that, or do I just have to know it's there and slow down?
Yes, you can change your score. I'm not sure that it's a realistic goal for too many people. I think the first step is to just recognize that you have a bias. And once you have a bias, you know that you don't want to act on that bias. You can consciously try to set it aside. So, for example, when I first became a judge, I kept a piece of notebook paper on the bench next to me. This is no technological marvel here. This is just basic old school pen and paper. Mm-hmm. And every time I sentenced a child, I would write down age and gender and race and charge and sentence. And I kept a list to see what I was doing and to see what my patterns were over time and could I learn something from that. And once I saw a pattern emerge, I could consciously try to take some steps to correct it, to make sure that at least in terms of race, I was giving the same sentence for the same act, and to try to deal with it as best I could. So there are things that you can do when you are aware of your bias. So internal motivation, wanting to be fair, helps a lot. And steps like that to actively monitor yourself, like I did with the notebook paper, helps a lot. But there's a tremendous body of research that's out now that's starting to explore other things. And the research is showing that just having good intentions may not be enough. And there are some things that you can do. You can make an effort to go out and spend time with people who don't look like you. And when you become more familiar with them and who they are and what they do, what you may discover is that they don't fit the stereotypes that you've been led to believe, and that having those kinds of personal interactions really do help to overcome some of these innate assumptions that we make. Another one is to counteract negative stereotypes with positive ones. So every time somebody says something to you that, let's say there's a racial stereotype, and it's an unpleasant one, whatever it happens to be, it can't hurt to then turn the conversation to what great parents Michelle and Barack Obama are, and how they've raised two wonderful daughters and are such great models of family values. And, you know, those kinds of comments can help to overcome some negative stereotypes that are out there. So if you are conscious of that, you can start to add things into the conversation, and over time, you can start to incorporate these ideas in your own head. And that these things really do make a difference.
That's interesting, because I was thinking about, as you were talking about, as a judge, how you sort of measured yourself, you know, that's a pretty clear way to look at it because you're making the decision. But then I'm turning inward and I'm thinking, as a lawyer, when I'm looking at placement options for children or a family's likelihood of success in reunification, I'm wondering if those are the places where lawyers need to kind of keep some record of how they're. It's a little less clear, I guess, is what I'm saying, is how, you know, how I'm trying to think of how a lawyer could measure their, how they work with kids and families.
Well, one of the areas in the child welfare world that comes up a lot that is just rife for racial bias is an issue around grandmothers. If you are raised in a certain culture, you may not think it's appropriate for grandmothers to be raising children. Or you may have some negative attitudes about grandmothers, quote unquote, having to raise children. But yet in other cultures, it's very common. And any lawyer who's involved in child welfare should really analyze what their feelings are about grandmothers raising children. Because it's something that can be problematic if you're hiding some, not hiding is the wrong word, if you have some internal ideas about that that are not expressed and really thought through. And it can't hurt for lawyers to start tracking how many cases they have involved children placed with grandmothers and whether that was a good thing or a bad thing. And I'm not saying that all grandmothers are wonderful people. There are grandmothers who commit child abuse also. But that's on an individual case. I'm saying, in general, do you have assumptions about that? Do you make cultural assumptions about grandmothers raising children? And I think that that's one area that's really significant in the child welfare world.
So if we're kind of thinking about the steps that a lawyer can take, step one is find out what your own are and then work from there. How would...
I think step one is to slow down.
Slow down.
And then step two is to figure out what your own implicit biases are.
Slow down, figure out your biases. And once you feel like you're kind of moving in a positive direction there, how do you then handle obvious bias in a system that involves many, many more people? Not every judge that you sit before is going to be sitting there writing it out and thinking, you know, is it going to have been through this training? And so are there strategies that can bring these things to light?
Well, let me first differentiate explicit bias from implicit bias. I think everybody knows explicit bias when they see it. If somebody should use the N-word, there's nothing implicit about that. And that needs to be called out immediately. It's like confronting a bully in grade school. You need to just call it out right then, right there. And unfortunately, if it happens to be a judge on the bench, you need to do it. And you need to have the professional courage to call it out. I just don't know how to say that any more strongly. I'd like to think that enough judges have been trained that they're not going to be explicitly biased from the bench. Every time it happens, it ends up in the newspaper and on television, and there are YouTube clips, and I mean, we've all seen them, and they're horrible. But I think they are fewer and fewer instances of that happening now. So that's a good thing.
I agree.
And that's why I said before, I think we're making some progress in the gender bias area. I don't hear so many stories where judges are saying demeaning things to women lawyers. I'm still hearing a little too much from other male lawyers, but I'm not hearing it from judges quite so much. So I take that as a little bit of movement in the right direction. Now, institutional racism or institutional bias is harder to necessarily see on a case-by-case basis. But if a lawyer has a feeling that all fill-in-the-blank X, all black parents or all black children or all Hispanic children, that something is happening to over time, then first of all, you need to do your research and find out if the data confirms it. You can get all kinds of demographic information from clerk's offices around the country. And if you want to know what the racial or gender makeup is of children in foster care or children in the delinquency system or what have you, that information is available around the country. It may be hard to find, but it's available, and it is public information. I know that it is in my state because I've done the research. I've also seen it in about 8 or 9 other states. So you've got to do your research. And like any good lawyer, you need to have your facts straight before you start raising an allegation. And if you've done your research and you find out that there is a problem which can be demonstrated, and let me underline that, it's got to be something that you can show with data, with multiple examples. It can't just be a gut feeling. But if you've got that, then it's an issue for lawyers to litigate. and say, this is a problem, and litigate it like you would any other constitutional issue, because I do think this is a serious constitutional issue. And if you do it properly, the legal system should be there to address the bias. That's sort of what the legal system is for.
Have you seen, in dependency in particular, any lawsuits that have resulted in changes, or is it primarily in delinquency because that is maybe more easily, you know, it's a little more clear in terms of like your piece of paper where you can kind of pull out four pieces of information and compare them, whereas dependency, it's a lot, you know, there's a lot of things that go into whether a parent is successful or whether a child goes to a foster home or a group home.
So I have seen it in dependency cases in the child welfare world as well. We had an agency in Miami that was, well, we have several agencies in Miami that are religious-based, but one in particular that we started to see trends and patterns that were quite disturbing. And the issue was litigated, and that agency was barred from handling any more cases.
Wow.
So it took good lawyers' work. It took a lot of work, but a bad actor got taken out of the system. So, yes, it is possible to do.
And that was in the actions were in placement of children or?
Both placement and treatment of children.
Okay. So that wraps up part one of my interview with Judge Scott Bernstein. Please join us for part two. You've been listening to the Children's Law Podcast brought to you by True North Child Advocates. Please take a moment to subscribe and spread the word. Thank you.